This is Mike Consa. Welcome to Novelist Spotlight. This is the podcast where I interview fiction writers about their novels and about their writing methods, the secrets to their success, their challenges, and so on. You're going to enjoy today's conversation because I've got Lorraine Duffy Merkel, who is my guest. And she was born in the Bronx, New York. She's been a New York City girl her entire life. She's written a few different novels. You'll enjoy her New York City accent and the many different subjects that we cover, everything from the challenges that she has had with weight and dieting to the secrets of success for her 40-year marriage, to the psychic rewards of fiction writing, to what she does for immediate gratification when it comes to writing, her use of pop culture as a jumping-off point for some of the things that she writes, and the use of the autobiographical in her fiction writing. So without further delay, allow my guest to introduce herself to you.
My name is Lorraine Duffy Merkel. I am a novelist. I have three novels. My latest is The Last Single Woman in New York City. Prior to that, I wrote Fat Chick and Back to Work She Goes. I'm also an essayist and a freelance creative director, writer for advertising agencies, and I'm a native New Yorker.
Meaning native New York City, correct, Lorraine? Because I'm a native New Yorker, but I'm from upstate New York. So you're a New York City girl, is that right?
I am a native New York City girl, yes.
Born and raised in the Bronx?
In the Bronx.
There we go. So this is Mike Consa, of course, your host. Thank you for joining us. I do have to say that one of the titles of the novels that Lorraine just mentioned is called Fat Chick. And the first thing that popped in my mind was, if I ever tried to write a novel like that, or any male name was on a novel like that, they might be called disgusting and insensitive. But women can get away with that. So tell us a little about, I actually want to start there, because did you write Fat Chick from the perspective of a heavyset woman, or is there something else going on there?
I wrote that because I have had, I have ridden the yo-yo dieting for, since I was 13. And so I wanted to write a story that was, I didn't want to write a memoir, but it is kind of autobiographical in many ways, and it's about a woman who's she's fat, she's thin, and her personality changes. You know, when she's I think on the back of the book it says she was this insecure fat chick, or she's a skinny bitch, and she's, you know, is there nothing in between? And eventually she finds a way to get to the middle.
So this must have been kind of therapeutic for you as well, because you, because it was autobiographical to some extent. I realize you fictionalized it. It was written and marketed as a novel. But was it therapeutic for you as well, because you kind of got to, I mean, so much of weight gain and loss is psychological. I mean, there's certain people who they stuff their emotions by eating a lot of food, or they, or when they're anxious, they don't have any appetite. Then there's a whole, I mean, there's even apps now that try to work on you psychologically, like what is it that triggers you to eat and eat more than you should. So what about that?
Well,
was it therapeutic for you?
It was because I got to tell a lot of stories, things that did happen to me, and I got to get them out there. But by talking about them through the character, I could be more honest about how it felt. And it, it felt good.
Did you go through some emotional, did you ever get emotional? And did you tear up at all? Has it been that kind of a rocky ride for you? Or is it not that emotional? Is it just kind of like, hey, I gained weight, I lost weight, I gained weight, I lost weight, like millions of other people out there. So I wanted to tell the story, but I didn't come a part of it.
I don't think I ever teared up or got emotional that way, but there were people who, when they read the book, I was hoping that they remembered the situation that I was describing and had a little remorse about how they behaved. It's interesting because that book was came out in 2009, and since then, a lot of things have changed about fat shaming. Like you said, I don't know if that title would have played in 2022 the way it played in 2009. But Josh Peck, who used to be on that Nickelodeon show, Drake and Josh, he just wrote his autobiography. And one of the things he talks about is his weight. And he talks about very, very openly how people think nothing of commenting when someone's overweight. They think nothing of saying to you, "Do you really need that donut?"
and wow.
And things like that. So I guess, props to him for just saying it outright and laying it on the line.
Where are you at right now? I mean, on the weight front, are you at your right weight right now?
No, I have crept up again from stress eating, but not that far that it can't be dealt with.
What has really worked for you? Because I did hear you use the word dieting, the D word, which a lot of people say right off the bat it won't work if it's dieting. It has to be a lifestyle change, and maybe that's what you've met over the years. Though you've obviously tried different things, you've experimented. Everybody does. So what really worked better for you than anything?
When I went on plans like a Weight Watchers, like a Jenny Craig, something like that.
We had support and
where I had support, uh-huh, and where I had portion control and where the food was easy to prepare, basically, because you just throw it in the microwave. It's a little harder if you're trying to lose weight and you're out with people and you're eating in a restaurant, and you don't want to be the person who's sitting there asking the waiter, "So can I want this entree, but do you do half portions, and or only eating half, and then I'll take the rest home with me?" You don't want the evening to revolve, because a lot of times, when people are on any kind of a diet or weight loss program or new health regime, they kind of, it becomes their MO. And then all of a sudden, it's all they talk about. And then they want other people to do it too. And when they're sitting there at dinner, they're telling everybody how many points, how many Weight Watchers points are in their entrees.
I've heard that before. Yeah.
Somebody orders another drink, and you say, "Do you know how many points are in that? Do you really want to have it?"
I hear people say, "I really want to devote my points to a glass of wine tonight, so I'm going to cut back on the bread. But I'm going to have that glass of wine because I deserve it tonight. I've been working hard, or I had a rough day." Do you have any desire to eat while you write? Do you keep snacks nearby. Is that part of the writing process for you, or when you're writing,
No.
does it take your mind away from the food?
No, when I'm writing, I'm concentrating. If I have anything, it's a Diet Coke. Just 'cause I get thirsty. And rather than water, just I guess the effervescence or something, it has sort of a bite to it.
Yes. Yeah,
So,
and it's a little festive to have some bubbles in there. You know, I don't
yeah.
want to spend the whole program talking about weight and dieting, but I will say that living in New York City, where people go out to eat all the time and you have incredible restaurants, I mean, it's hard not to get a good meal in New York.
Right.
It must make it all the more difficult.
It can, especially since my husband is an amateur chef and he's also a foodie. So he always likes to go to restaurants a couple of nights a week, and he makes really good food. So
Oh yeah, so he makes something new, and of course you want to. He wants you to taste it. He wants to get some kudos for another turning out another good recipe. And but you know, it sounds fun for you, but also a challenge. So,
It's kind of the irony of life, you know, when somebody who has weight issues marries somebody who likes to cook.
does your husband support your writing, or do you ever have these situations where? It's kind of like, you know, you're sitting alone in a room all day, and I don't get to talk to you, and I can't walk in and interrupt because you shush me because you're in the middle of a thought. How does that work, husband and wife? You're the writer. I don't know what he does other than cooking, but
He's
does it?
a lawyer.
Oh, he's a lawyer. Okay, so he's probably a talker. Lawyers tend to be quite articulate and like to talk. Of course, he writes himself. Although it's so stultified, I mean the legal writing. But is that ever an issue? He's probably out of the house and busy a lot of the time anyway.
He is my since we had children, my life was at home as a stay-at-home mother, and he was outside of the home. He supports me, I mean, literally and figuratively, and he you know, I always go to tell him when I have a some kind of writing success, and he'll say, "You know, what do you write about?" I think he would like me to write more reported pieces, whereas I like writing essays, and he will tease me, and he'll say, "Because it's all about you," and I say, "Yes, it is. It's all about me," and so yeah, he would like me to write more reported pieces. He's a very pragmatic person, and I am more emotional, and so that's why I do like to write essays, because I like connecting with people on that level, and I think people like to feel like they're not alone in a situation. So
Yes.
when you write about something that happened to you, and somebody goes, "Oh my God, it happened to somebody else too."
Yes.
And then they had it, you know, people always want to know, because sometimes people don't know how to handle something. And I'm not talking about something catastrophic. I mean, you know, there's a bully at school, or there's a mom that takes over every play date, or there's a rude, I don't know, storekeeper, but they're the only people in your neighborhood who sell something that you need, so you can't just blow them off. You know, how do you handle it when this such and such happens? And by reading what you did, that can kind of give them some kind of insight as to how they might handle a situation. So
Yes.
that's why I like essays.
Yeah. And your writing is there's self-exploration involved in your writing. Certainly with Fat Chick, there was some self-exploration. You also have this title, Back to Work She Goes, which you have children who are, how many children do you have?
Two.
And are they grown and out of the house?
Yeah, they're adults. They're
okay,
in their 20s.
so you had to go back to work, or you decided to go back to work, maybe, is what I'm kind of just intuiting from that title. Was that a little bit of a self, a little bit of a memoir?
That was part of it's about a stay-at-home mother who was freelancing, as I was, and she decides she wants to go back to work. I never went back to work on premises. So it was written in 2013. It was sort of a reimagining of my life. But on her journey to finally getting a job offer, we go through all these different scenarios, all these different freelance on-premises jobs that she goes to in hopes that they will want to hire her. And all those scenarios, I did not have to make them up because I experienced all of it. The person who's keeps giving you work and keeps telling you that eventually it's going to turn into a full-time job, and it never does. The place where you go to where they're they kind of insult you while you're sitting there, and they go, "So what's, you were working at home? Really? How did you do that with the kids crying and the refrigerator a few feet away and the TV on?" And I actually lost a job, and so does the character in the book, when I said to the person, "Well, how do you get your job done when you have people, you know, coming in your office and bothering you, and you've got the video player on all day long, and you've got the snack bar a few feet away?" You know, it's the same
distractions
thing.
Yeah.
So there are a whole bunch of stories like that, and I enjoyed writing because I got to get all those stories out and having them all in one place to just give people the sense of what being a freelancer, even an on-premises freelancer, is like, and all these different nobody can just go to work and do their job. And when you go in as a freelancer and you see these places from the outside, as an outsider, I always think if the people who actually worked here could see what it looks like, they'd probably quit. unlike me, eventually I had the main character go back to work, which has happened to a lot of people I know, but that wasn't my situation, because just when I got out of being a stay-at-home mother, because my children outgrew me being home or needing me to be home, my mother is elderly, and she needed me to then become a stay-at-home daughter. So
yes.
That's what happened. So I never kind of went back to work on premises, but it worked out fine. I wrote another book.
Well, you wrote your most recent one is called The Last Single Woman in New York City.
Yes.
And I think you said that is what you didn't want to do is write a novelization of Sex and the City. It's different than that. Tell us about that book.
Right. Well, with the success of Sex and the City, everybody wanted to be the next Candace Bushnell, and was suddenly a sex or dating columnist or whatever. And that really that didn't interest me. I just it this book has been in the making since 2005. So I wrote two other novels before I even got this one down. But it started, I hate to say this, kind of ass backwards, with the title. In about 2005, Rudy Giuliani's ex-wife, Donna Hanover, she wrote a book called My Boyfriend's Back. And it was about women who, in their later years, eventually end up connecting with a high school or college boyfriend. And that's what happened to her. And I think it was the New York Post promoted the book. And then they did a sidebar where they talked to a lot of New York women who that happened to them as well. And one of the women said she was so glad when her high school boyfriend reconnected with her, because she had been on the dating scene for so long and she was beginning to feel like the last single woman in New York City. And I thought that was the greatest title for a book that I had ever heard. And I wrote it down and I said, I am going to write this book. And then it took me a very long time, probably like a decade, to even start thinking about what to write. And I had a false start because I thought my original idea was just this woman who every time she turns around, somebody she knows is getting engaged. And that's why she is the last single woman in New York City. And I wrote several chapters and it was just so boring. And I didn't even want to read it, so I didn't know why anybody else would want to read it. So I put that aside for a while. And then I became, in pop culture, what seemed to happen, and this has nothing to do with writing or anything, I just found that all these people were like in the vein of Real Housewives. You know, they were getting some kind of popularity and then they wanted to capitalize that. And suddenly everybody was a guru. And if they were married and they got divorced, they were suddenly the post-divorce guru. Or if they were single and they got married, they were the how to find a man and live happily ever after guru. And I saw how many people were following people like that. And it kind of made me sad that people were so lost or just looking for a guru to tell them how to put their lives right. And they were putting all their trust in people who really didn't have any credentials except that, you know, they wanted to be famous.
Right.
And
right.
Then what would happen is this self-proclaimed guru would kind of go back on themselves. The person who was telling you how to find a man and get married, well, that person would get divorced. Or how to live a great post-divorce life, that guru would end up in rehab or say, you know, and they would kind of eventually show themselves as somebody that didn't know what they were talking about in the first place. And it was really upsetting me. And one day I said, it just kind of hit me. I said, this is what the book needed. It needs an antagonist. And this is the kind of antagonist that it needs. This woman who is jilted at the altar and she's trying to get she wants to get back in the game, but she does, but she doesn't. And then all of a sudden, people in her life are getting married, and engaged, and she's kind of like the odd woman out.
Right. Well, let me say that person, that protagonist, is Samantha Sam Dennehy. She's jilted at the altar. Why did she have so much difficulty finding a husband? I mean, I shouldn't even ask that question, I suppose, because lots of people have trouble finding spouses. What are the issues that she faced? And did you see her as emblematic of women across New York City or across America as to the issues that she ran into trying to find a lifelong mate?
No, I kind of based her a little bit on me. And I thought, what if my husband and I were together about 6 years before we got engaged, and then we were engaged for a year, and now we've been together 40 years. But I kind of thought, what if things took a turn? And what, you know, you're with somebody for a very long time, and then right before you're supposed to get married, or even if you're not supposed to get married, just you've been with somebody a really long time, and then they decide to move in a different direction without you. And that can really throw you for a loop, because you don't know how to live your life without that person, because you've lived your life with that person for so long.
You're right.
And
right.
So that's why for a long time in her life, she was kind of the person who had somebody, and other people in her life didn't have it with the intensity that she had. And now she was, again, odd woman out, because other people in her life now were getting married or getting engaged. And I think the twist is she ends up through business meeting this woman who's her handle is the anti-wife. And she doesn't believe in marriage. She doesn't even believe marriage should exist, and that's her whole shtick.
Marriage then? Is it just people should stay together if they want to be together, but don't go through the legal formality of getting married?
Yes.
Okay.
And she's written a book, and she's going to have a reality show, and Sam's job as a marketer is to help promote this woman's show. And she ends up, she starts out skeptical, and she ends up, you know, becoming a disciple. And as you know, as I described before, it takes her a while. It takes her losing her friends and her family. We're not really losing them. She kind of turns her back on them because she's really following this anti-wife, and eventually she kind of sees that maybe the I call her P.T. Barnum in heels and hair extensions. And
clever. Now, you and your husband have been together for 40-plus years, I think you just said, and what is the secret to an enduring marriage? If you were to boil it down to one or two things that you would advise people, because it's people change over decades, and and a lot of times that's why people have been together, you know, 20, 30 years, and they come apart. What's the secret there, whether it's a secret or not?
I don't know if there's a secret, and I know people, when they're asked that, they always come up with these kind of boilerplate answers, like communication and never go to bed mad, you know, like all these little axioms.
Right.
But I really believe that people who want to stay married just stay married, and people who don't find a way to get out of it.
Some people are marrying types, I would say. Some men and women like being married. I mean, they're comfortable with that. Yeah. They want a partner for life, and nothing necessarily supersedes that. It's not like, okay, so we had an argument, or, you know, we don't always like the same types of vacations, but I like being with this person. I'd rather be married, and that's it. And it almost sounds like that's what you're saying, that some people are suited for it.
Yeah, and I believe that too. And I actually have an article coming out in an AARP publication called The Ethel, that's marketed to older women, where I wrote about how, you know, people never really stop to think, is it really for them? Because we've been told there's a natural progression to life. You meet somebody and you go out for a while and then you get married and then you have a family, and that is the natural progression for some people. It was for me. But that's not what everybody wants, or what everybody, not everybody can sustain that.
I think a lot of times, I mean, I've just seen people over the years are controlling. It could be a man, it could be a woman. And being controlling can oftentimes ruin a marriage. Let me jump to another subject, though. You went to Fordham University. You're a Fordham Ram. What did you study? You got your bachelor's degree there. What did you study?
I studied communications and marketing.
Did you know what you wanted to do when you came out of school? What your intent was with that line of study?
Yeah, I wanted to be an advertising copywriter.
Which you are, or you were, or you are.
I was on premises for 15 years, and then when my first child was born in 1995, I went freelance, and I was doing that freelance until about 2004. And then what happened was, freelancers can always tell when the economy is changing. And I started to see a shift. People were keeping a lot of assignments in-house, and then they didn't have a lot of assignments for in-house or out-of-house. And then the people who used to give me work were calling me to see where the freelance was, because they had just lost their job.
Well, there was a big shift in the ad industry that I'm sure you lived through, which was ad agencies, when they had work, they'd hire people. And then they'd fire people when the accounts went fallow, or they jumped to another agency. And then they decided, well, this is ridiculous. We keep hiring people and firing people. Why don't we just contract with them? We give them the work when we have it. We pay them to do the work. So it's a much more of a freelance environment. Obviously, an ad agency has a core of people, like artistic directors and account managers and all that. But there was that big shift in the industry that I'm sure you were part of. Not that that's, you said that you had a child and that really dictated that you needed to be at home, and you can do the work from home easily enough.
Right. And also a lot of agencies were swallowing up other agencies. So then all of a sudden they, like two agencies combined, but you didn't need double the people. Mm-hmm. So then a lot of those people got laid off. And then they wanted to keep things in-house. Actually, that was where I was when that was the shift that I saw. I think the gig economy came a little later, and that worked in my favor because I was freelance then. But then, as I said, around 2004, things were not going well. And And I'm not really somebody who sits around.
No.
You know, I needed to do something else. And I started writing essays.
Well, let me ask you this. I want to get to this copywriting, because advertising copywriting is very succinct. It's sort of like an arrow. You want it needs to hit a person like an arrow. It's supposed to stick in their minds. And it's a different kind of writing, but it's a very compact and pithy sort of writing. Did that have a positive effect on your fiction writing? Do you feel like there's a carryover there at all?
A carryover in the sense of
your practice and training in your long career. I mean, you did this for years, for quite a while. Do you tend to sometimes, while you're writing a piece of fiction or working on a novel, try to turn a phrase in a way that's more like advertising copywriting, something that's really like an arrow that really strikes and brings a kind of an arresting phrase?
That's what I was going to say. I'm good with a turn of phrase. And I think I got that from writing headlines. Or taglines as well. My fiction is full of these little, I don't know what you call them, buttons or zingers, that kind of will bring a chuckle, when you're reading it. But no, they're separate. They're separate ways of writing, and I actually I'm enjoying the essays more. I don't do that much advertising anymore. I only do it when someone I know in the industry, you know, calls me and says, "Can you help me out?" But I don't seek out the work anymore.
Right.
The business has really changed, and I knew that it was kind of over for me when I had read, I think it was in the New York Times, the marketing section, it said that companies were going to advertise or do campaigns on Snapchat. And
right.
I thought, well, I don't use Snapchat. I don't even understand why anybody would use Snapchat. So how am I going to advertise on Snapchat?
At the same time, you say that you're really into pop culture. Now, you do say books, movies, TV shows. You don't say Snapchat or necessarily social media.
Right.
But pop culture. Talk about your affinity for pop culture and how that plays into your novel writing.
In the novel, I use a lot of references.
And only your latest one, or all of them?
All of them.
Yeah.
All of them.
Okay.
There are always references that, I guess, in, you know, several years, it might, somebody could look at it and say, well, this is dated because she's talking about this model who isn't famous anymore, or this TV show that hasn't been on in a long time. But in the moment, it just seems right to use references that people know.
Well, you know who's a gigantic seller of novels and uses pop culture very liberally is Stephen King. He drops pop culture references in his novels all the time.
And why not? And why not remind people, even if they read your novel 20 years from now, it's a nice way to kind of show people what was going on at the time.
With Google, you can always, I don't know what that means, and you can always find out within seconds.
Yeah. And it actually, pop culture is actually more important to me in my essay writing, because if I read something or I watch something that really touches me, you know, and reminds me of a story or something, I turn that into an essay.
What is the most... Finish that thought.
Oh, I was going to say, I use it as a jumping off point. And sometimes it doesn't even have to be a movie or a TV show or something. It can be something that's in the paper.
Gotcha.
You know, a story that's in the paper. For example, a few years ago, there was, on Staten Island, there was this big to-do because the school in Staten Island wanted to get rid of the father-daughter dance. Half the school, I guess, who didn't have fathers in the picture, they didn't want the dance because they didn't want those girls to feel bad or left out. And then the people who did have fathers in the picture, they didn't want their girls denied the chance to have this nice, you know, this nice evening with their dads. And I had kind of been on both sides of this coin, and I wrote about how... I use that as the jumping off point, and then I wrote my own story about how my parents had separated for a while, so I missed out on a lot of father-daughter stuff in grammar school, and they got back together when I was in high school, and the first thing my new high school had was a father-daughter dance, and I was like first online to get my ticket. You know, and it's still a very nice memory for me. So I understand how you can feel bad if you're not able to participate, but it for those who can participate, it's a nice memory to have. And I sold that to the New York Daily News in, I think, an hour.
Well, that didn't take long. What are your challenges when you're writing a novel? You talk about challenges to writing novels. Is there any impediment that you would point to, Lorraine, and say, if I could clear this, if I could change that, it would really kind of open the gates and I'd be a faster and more effective fiction writer?
I think that the challenge that I see is a challenge that stops a lot of people. And it's, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to write this whole thing, and then I'm not going to be able to get an agent. I'm not going to be able to get a publisher. It's so competitive. I'm going to end up self-publishing and 10 people are going to buy this book. And you're already discouraged by the time, you know, before you even write the first page. And that stops a lot of people from writing. And then some people plow ahead and hope for the best. And, when you're a creative person, it's very hard because it is so competitive. And
talk about the psychic rewards of writing. I mean, if you write and you do only sell a small number of novels and you're never going to be a bestseller, which is 99% of fiction writers out there, and yet they continue to write. They continue to write because they get something out of that. What are the psychic rewards of writing from your standpoint?
Well, the rewards of writing are that I like to tell stories. And it's a lot. And I just like to tell the story and put it out there and have you read it. And I get more satisfaction from that than sitting down and telling somebody the story to their face, because a lot of times when you're telling somebody a story, they might not be in the headspace to hear the story, or they're half listening, or they're just waiting for you to finish so that they can say what they want to say or tell you their story. When I put it down on paper, it's there, and you can read it when you're ready to read it, and I have your full attention. And so I like that. I also, what kind of keeps me from, you know, checking my Amazon ranking every 10 seconds is the writing of the essays, and especially when, as I said before, I write something, and if I'm not struggling with it, if it just keeps coming, and I get it down on the page pretty quickly, I just have this sense, this is going to sell. And then, especially when I when I put it out there, and it sells, you know, like I said, I sell it in an hour. That is just such a shot in the arm that it gives me the impetus to keep going.
So the and I should say you didn't go through the list, but you're a journalist in addition to being a novelist, and you've written for many publications, including the New York Times, the New York Observer, New York Post, New York Press, New York Daily News, Adweek Magazine, the Washington Post, Huffington Post, and so on. Many others than that. But there's much more immediate gratification in being able to dash off an essay. Not that it's that simple that you just dash it off, but being able to write an essay and get it published in a major newspaper or magazine is a much more immediate gratification than writing an entire novel and then getting it out there and watching the Amazon rankings.
Yeah, and the thing is, though, that one of the key things that if you have a publicist, or your publishing company has a publicist or whatever, one of the things they tell you to do in order to promote your book is to write something like an essay or some kind of article, because then that's in your byline. Your book is in your byline. And if people like what you wrote, there's a better chance that then they're going to say, oh, she wrote a book. So if they liked your essay and they enjoyed your writing, then you're that's the advertising for your book. So the more essays you write, the more exposure your book is getting in your byline.
Yes.
So one, it's also a marketing tool. It's a way to get your ideas out and your stories out, but it's also a marketing tool for your book.
Now, you also say that you're frustrated by the fact that negativity sells more readily than the positive. Talk about that.
Well, it just seems, you know, I belong to a lot of Facebook groups, writing Facebook groups, where people post their essays and their writing. And this has nothing to do with the quality of the writing or anything like that. It's just that it's the topics can be very much of a downer when it comes to, even though they might, they say essays begin in whimsy and end in wisdom or something like that.
I like
and
that.
Sometimes there's no whimsy. So they try to end in some kind of wisdom, but they start out by saying, you know, I just found out I have cancer, so I'm doing this. And it's like, oh.
So it's a dirge. I mean, right off the bat, you know, it's going to be a dirge. And then hopefully that wisdom at the end. Tell me about I suspect that you wanted to write something positive over the years, maybe on several occasions where the would-be editor that you're trying to get to give you the green light said, we're not interested in that subject. Are there some positive subjects that you wanted to write about that you just couldn't sell?
Whenever I wrote something, I felt like I was writing something positive about marriage, or positive about children, and liking being a mother, or something. It just didn't have the bite that people wanted. Or, I talk to an editor and they'd say, "Yeah, but don't you think?" And they would try to take my story and turn it into a negative. And at one point, somebody wanted to take a positive story about motherhood, and she was really like at me to try to like break me and make me admit that that I was lying and that it wasn't all that great. And I at one point I just said, I don't think this is going to work out. I inside me is not the black heart of Betty Draper, who like really hates her children and hates Ossning and hates her husband, and there it just it
That is a
that's not
great
in me.
pop culture reference right there, Lorraine, because I loved Mad Men. What a great series.
And so that was one re relationship that didn't work out, the editor-writer relationship. And so that's what I found. And I remember I wrote something about it on a, kind of like in a writer's chat room, and we were all talking about it, and a lot of other people were saying the same thing. Why do I have to write something negative in order to get published? And it can be hard, especially if, something good happens to you.
It says something
And
about human nature, you know. We tend to favor the negative, and that's not the most appealing part of human nature, but we do tend to gravitate towards the negative. It's part of the human condition, unfortunately.
I think it's part of it's seen as problem solving. So if you present this, I just read something about somebody who had cancer, and it's like, I just got a cancer diagnosis, so I bought a house plant. And the story was about how the person, it they were like in this house where death might be imminent. They brought life into the house with the house plant,
Yes.
and it gave them something to take care of, and that gave them the impetus to take care of themselves, and on and on like that. And it was a very, very poignant, essay. Don't get me wrong, and I'm sure maybe there's somebody who got that same diagnosis who went out and bought a house plant because that story spoke to them, which is a good thing, which is a positive thing.
Yes.
But it's there's always this overarching doom that's I lost my job and then I did this. I got the cancer diagnosis and I did that. My marriage fell apart and so I went there.
It's like a country music song. My dog died, my woman left me, and what good is life anymore?
And
yeah.
The truck got a flat tire.
And I should say old country music. Country music has gotten a more positive in recent years, for sure. You know, Lorraine, this has been very interesting, but before we sign off, I want just to give you an opportunity to say to the audience any parting thoughts, anything else we should know about Lorraine Duffy Merkel, or anything that you want to leave aspiring writers with, anything at all?
Well, yeah, I would like to tell inspiring writers that one thing that from Stephen King that always stuck with me, he said not only write, but to read, because I think, you know, becoming a better writer, read good writing.
For sure.
And that'll help you become a better writer. And also, write every day. And know that a lot of, you know, there are times when I sit down and I think of this idea for an essay, and I will spend like 4 hours writing this essay, and by the time I'm done, I go, this is for the trash bin, you know, but at least I spent the time writing. It just became an exercise rather than something that I could sell or get produced. But the exercise of writing keeps you writing, keeps you sharp.
Right.
And in fact, during the pandemic, I actually had several months of a writer's block from the beginning of 2020 until the spring. It was like 4 months. And I ended up taking a job that I thought was kind of beneath me. It was for one of these, beneath me only because it was so, it was like entertainment, kind of trivial stuff, you know, these websites that mm-hmm. have, where they would give you a prompt and, you know, 10 reasons Gilmore Girls was a great mother-daughter role model show, and five reasons why it wasn't. And then you just sit there and you write the 10 reasons that it was and the five reasons that it wasn't. And I am... that kept me writing every day, and until I got unblocked. But writing every, if I hadn't had that, I don't know if I would have had the wherewithal to sit down and write every day, because the pandemic kind of shook me a bit, because it throws off your routine and everything. But writing every day can make all the difference, even when you're writing trivial stuff about, you know, Gilmore Girls, etc.
Yeah. Lorraine, thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me. This was so great. I really enjoyed talking to you.